We are talking once again with Job Parrish and Maria Tomchik, local writers and activists, here to give us a wrap-up of this past week's news. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
All right. Seattle teachers strike settled?
Yeah, well, they have a proposed contract. The individual, the members of the teachers union have to vote on it, and that is happening as we speak. And the details of the contract are not made public until the vote is finalized and the contract is approved. That's usual for union ratification processes. But we do know that they had an agreement. They got 7% cost of living increase, which is more than the state mandated 5.5 and more than the district was proposing, which was 6. So that is an improvement. And they did get some concessions also on the question of the internal computerized way that the district wants to allocate teachers in different school districts. So, you know, class sizes, things like that. So we'll find out the details if it gets approved by the union. The Seattle School Board has to approve it as well, and that will be coming up later this month. So, but classes have resumed. That's the good news. So they started again on Wednesday, and students only missed a couple days of class. So that was good. It was a mercifully short strike, at least so far. The strike has been suspended, is the official terminology, and it will be over when the contract is ratified.
All right, moving on. We talked about the police candidate forum that happened on Thursday. Last week we mentioned that it was coming up.
Yes, and this and excuse me. Last night, I listened to the recording, and had some impressions of the candidate forum that I just wanted to talk about. Okay, so there were over 150 questions submitted by the public, and then 6 questions were developed from that, whatever that means. And each of the 3 candidates was asked all 6 of those questions, and then one more that I thought was kind of a stupid question. But the 3 candidates in the forum were current interim director, or current interim SPD chief Adrian Diaz, assistant SPD chief Eric Greening, and Tucson assistant chief Kevin Hall. So with the first question, what I thought was interesting is in Adrian Diaz's answer to the first question, there was already a bombshell. Okay. And that first question was, what policing alternatives do you support and how would you prioritize this work as chief of police? That was the very first question. Mm-hmm. And Diaz, right out of the gate, was clearly in the position of defending and talking up what the department is currently doing, even if they're doing it in response to the 2020 protests and demands by the city council. So, for example, he bragged up the fact that the department is doing a review of 911 calls to see which ones can be assigned to civilian responders. But that's something that the city council asked the mayor and the SPD to do. It's not something that it was Diaz's decision to do. He didn't make that decision. That was the city council who demanded that. Interestingly, Diaz then said that the SPD has identified 10 to 15% of the calls as ones that civilian responders can handle. And this is the very first time anyone from the executive, whether it's from the mayor's office or from the SPD, has come out with a real number instead of just stalling whenever a council member has asked for the results of the SPD analysis of 911 calls. Previous reps from the mayor's office and the SPD have sat in city council meetings and they've said repeatedly, we're not done with the analysis yet. That's been the official line. So this was amazing. In his very first response, Diaz came out and said that what they're going to be presenting at the next public safety committee meeting is, no, it's not 49%, you know. it's 10 to 15. Okay.
Although it's, I have heard that number floated out in other
meetings. I've heard 12%. Yeah.
Yeah, but they never really owned it, you know.
Yeah, but they said, "Oh, you know, we're still working on it. We're still working on it." And Lisa Herbold usually, and Andrew Lewis, they usually push back and they go, "Well, look, the National Institute for Criminal Justice Reform, Nick Jr., they took all the 911 call data from Seattle from the years 2017 to 2019. And what they found in their report is that 80% of Seattle's 911 calls were non-criminal calls and that 49% should be handled by organizations other than the Seattle Police Department. How does that square with the number of 10 to 15%? Okay. So really Diaz is coming down on the side of officers who don't want to give up work, right? And the mayor who doesn't really want to see any new alternatives to policing, essentially. So there's Diaz kind of doubling down on the no, we're not in this for making any kind of change, right? And then Eric Greening, who was the other person, the other candidate from the SPD, he said that he supports different 911 responders like the community service officers who are in his department, right? But it's important to note for people to know that the community service officers have been gophers for SPD officers in the past rather than an actual civilian response. And I mean, Council Member Teresa Mosqueda has been particularly concerned about the SPD's use of the community service officers as like personal assistants rather than and even using them as a pipeline for new recruits into the SPD rather than allowing them to function as a real civilian response team in the past. So it's really important to remember that that's the role that community service officers have played in the past. Now, Kevin Hall, the candidate from Tucson, he was the only one of the three to mention pre-arrest diversion programs, okay, because that's what he's actually worked on for the last 5 or 6 years. And he's gone around the nation with a team of people to train other police departments on how to implement diversion, pre-arrest diversion programs. He mentioned adding crisis clinicians to the 911 call center, and he made a really interesting point, which is that these programs like civilian medical response or mental health response teams really depend on consistent funding, and that here in Washington State, our state has opted for Medicare expansion, whereas where he's from, down in Texas hasn't opted to expand Medicare.
I thought he was.
And Medicaid.
Arizona.
Yeah, but Arizona, Texas, that area, he's actually helped Houston as well to implement pre-arrest diversion programs. That's one of the departments that he has consulted with. That states like Texas, Arizona, and some of the other places where he's worked on these programs, they have not expanded Medicare or Medicaid. So, here in the state of Washington, a program like the Crisis Clinicians could be a third-party organization that would get paid through the Washington State Medicaid, Medicare expansion program instead of the city having to fund them, which I thought was a really, really good point. And that would really be awesome. So in terms of who gave the best answer to that question, I think that was Hall. And it's interesting because he's not from the state of Washington, and yet he knows a whole lot more about how things are set up here than apparently the other two candidates. So now the second question was about gun violence. And both Diaz and Greening gave answers that showed that they're big fans of hotspot policing. And they both kind of fell back on the rhetoric that is being used here in the city of Seattle to talk up the need for police and the need for more police. And I think you have a clip of Diaz's response.
I do. Just over 2.5 minutes.
Okay.
Let's hear it.
What is your plan to address increased violence and the prevalence of firearms in Seattle?
Yeah, so that's a great question because, you know, 2 years ago we actually saw – we started seeing the increase in violent crime. We saw staffing reduction in the department. And right away, we tried to make sure that we were getting ahead of it. In 2019, we saw 323 shots fired. Last year, we saw 621. So we almost doubled the amount of shots fired that were in the city. We actually hit a 25-year high in 2020 in regards to homicides. So this is a huge concern. In 2021, we actually saw a reduction of homicides almost by 15%. And a part of that is we took a good analysis. So I look at it this. The way we look at it is what we call CAPE, which is Community Analytics, Prevention, Environment, Enforcement. Community, it's using community partners, those violence interrupters, the people that are actually able to help reduce the potential violence, or even community partners that are just, you know, calling 911 or, you know, when they see it an issue that's coming about. All of that is we have a shared responsibility to address all of our violence. The second thing is analytics. So we look at hotspot policing. We look at you know, identifying those that have a propensity for to be the shot, the person doing the shooting. And we analyze that. In fact, we've actually done a really good job that 25% of our shootings have a homeless nexus. So how do we address that? And that's one of the things that we're working with the unified care team and addressing those that have those encampments that literally are have a high propensity for violence. The third thing is prevention, which we are working on extreme risk protection orders, getting guns out of the hands of people that might hurt themselves or hurt others, that we're looking at safe storage, so getting guns that are locked up so that way they're not in the streets. So they might find legislation in that. The fourth thing is environment. So how do you clean up an area? So how do you put lighting in the area, cut back brush? How do you establish areas so people can start walking the community? And then the last thing is emphasis. It's enforcement. It's really going out and trying to make sure that you're focused on an area and then doing that level of enforcement, taking guns off the streets. This year alone, we've actually recovered 875 guns this year. We're on pace to recover the same amount of guns that we had when we had full staffing. We had over 400 more officers. So officers are working hard every single day, but we've actually been able to really put, because of the way we're actually addressing this, we've actually been able to recover more guns than we've ever had before.
Okay, so that was very interesting. I mean, the first, right off the bat, the first thing that I'm responding to is the shots fired metric.
Yeah, so, and there's a lot that he didn't say.
Yeah.
That we don't know about. For instance, you know, how many shots fired, how many incidents is that? How many casualties were involved? Because with automatic handguns, you can have a whole lot of shell casings. Without having any injuries, for example. Mm-hmm. So we don't know.
Yeah, and I think in the past they've owned up and said, well, the shots fired metric is actually the number of shell casings we pick up at the scene of a crime, you know, or it's how many shots witnesses told us they heard. Okay, and it doesn't correlate to number of injuries, number of people injured, or necessarily to number of homicides. And so that's why you see that or hear that shots fired metric being trotted out all the time at media conferences and stuff given by members of the SPD and the mayor's office. Now, he does talk about how there's a 25-year high of homicides, but then Diaz doesn't give a number. Okay, so that 25-year high, is it just a couple higher than it was, than it's been in 25 years? You know, is it way higher? You know, what it doesn't talk about, you know, what are the causes necessarily. For example, we know that homicides and gun violence goes up in times of desperation, economic desperation. And during the pandemic, there were a lot of people who could not work. And there were a lot of people who were really economically desperate. So that metric of shots fired and that increasing number of homicides, I think that's something that every city, every community around the United States has seen, particularly with the number of guns that we have in our society. You know, it's not unique to Seattle, and it doesn't necessarily correlate to the number of SPD officers on the street. And then
we've seen that kind of rise in every major American city.
Yeah.
Is the trend in Seattle more than in other cities? Is it less? We don't know. Chances are, if it was more, they'd be talking about it that way. And if it was a significant increase in homicides over past years, they'd be talking about it. So chances are they're not using those statistics because they don't shine the need for additional officers in the most positive possible light.
Yeah. So, and then he goes on to talk about how community partners are really important in reducing gun violence. And then he mentions Violence Interrupters, which is a great program to help reduce gun violence. But then he very quickly shifts and says it can just be people calling 911. It can just be community members calling 911. And then he goes on to talk a little bit more about them. So you can kind of see instead of saying, hey, we helped implement these violence interrupter programs, we helped, you know, reduce gun violence by, you know, supporting these community groups of people with lived experience who are, you know, meeting with youth, trying to stop violence before it occurs, et cetera. He just says people calling 911, which shows you the emphasis that our current police department has, right?
Yeah.
I was intrigued by his comment, which I've seen trotted out in the media previously, and it didn't get the attention it deserved, at least in terms of examination. 25% of shootings have a homeless nexus.
Yes.
Which to me really is like a dog whistle for focusing on homeless camps. What do they mean by a homeless nexus? And what is the homeless nexus?
Mm-hmm. The homeless nexus refers to where shots are fired. So if they pick up shell casings near a homeless encampment, then they call it a homeless nexus.
Yeah,
right?
But what is
it's the same as him talking about cleaning up a neighborhood, like cutting back brush. He also means encampment sweeps so that people can quote unquote walk in their neighborhood.
Yeah.
I don't know of any place in Seattle where you can't walk, except for places that don't have sidewalks, which is an SDOT or Seattle Department of Transportation issue. But, it's this perception that, you know, graffiti, litter, shell casings, hypodermic needles, homeless people are all aspects of terrible violent crime when they're really not.
When you hear Bruce Harrell talk about data-driven policies, you got to question who's doing the driving and where they're driving it to.
Yeah.
And in this case, it's all being driven toward blaming the homeless for violent crime, which is a total canard. But if you throw enough numbers at people, they'll just nod their heads because it's overwhelming.
Yeah, and so in this case, Diaz was throwing a whole lot of initiatives at people saying, look at all the stuff we're doing, and it's really not very much.
Yeah.
Okay. So in answering that second question, I mean, Greening, the assistant SPD chief, he said a lot of the same things Diaz did, but he also admitted that the shots fired metric is shell casings picked up at the scene of the crime. Okay. Which was, I thought, really interesting. Kevin Hall from the Tucson SPD, he said that hotspot policing, which is what Diaz was talking about there, hotspot policing can work, but it's only a temporary solution. When the cops move on from doing their, you know, sweep through a hotspot, the crime usually comes right back. Right. Particularly if you don't address the root causes of the violence with things like investigations of violent incidents, with providing social services to people who need it, and doing community based intervention, which is that violence interrupter type programs that Diaz kind of paid lip service to, but then didn't talk about in any detail. So again, to the second question, Hall had the best answer. Right. And then the third question was, does the SPD need a culture change, and how would you go about achieving this? I think you also have a great clip of Adrian Diaz's answer to that question, Mike. Sorry, I didn't give you a whole lot of warning.
The third question is this. Does SPD need a culture change? And if so, how would you go about achieving this?
Short answer is yes. The one answer is that there's a positive and a negative culture. right? You things are that are positive. You want to be able to really keep up, and you really so. We have an EMT program, emergency medical technician program, that people are excited to do, and you want to keep that. You want that to flourish. You want officers engaged and really just passionate about what they do. So that doesn't need to change. But the negative side, where you really create this environment of people that are just not happy with their level of work. It's been a very difficult time over the last 2 years. You know, we've gone through the riots. We lost a precinct. We gained a precinct back. So that's been a very, very tough time on our officers. They've lost their fellow officers that they used to be partners with. And so really you're trying to figure out how do you create that level of wellness? And it's really about making sure that our officers are whole. So we've put in psychologists into our precincts. We've brought in wellness dogs. We're actually doing a variety of different things that really enhance our officers' experience. The other thing that I'm doing is that it really is going to change the way we police and the way we actually train our officers. Is I created it's under my Relational Policing Initiative, the SPD before the badge. So we bring in recruits 45 days prior to the academy and teach them on social emotional learning, brain development, trauma informed practices. And the other things that we're putting them in an environment where they're actually doing listening sessions with community to understand the history of the community that they're going to be policing. And that is an eye opener for them. It's an experience that for them to really understand like how they can actually change and be part of the community. And if we hire 100 officers over the next 5 years and communities engage in this project, that's over half the department that will really have this new level of culture shift. And it's really going to end up really enhancing our ability to build the bridges with our community more than we ever have. So, yeah. Yes.
I guess just one quick follow-up on that, because we have a little extra time here. SPD and the City of Seattle has been talking about culture change in the police department for some time. And I think you've mentioned some of these programs that might be different, but what is different now? What could you bring that would be different?
Yeah, so, you know, even as this SPD before the badge, but we're actually using technology and we're doing a variety of different things for us to really kind of change the dynamic of how we actually look at policing, how we actually enhance our services. So, for example, we built equity, accountability, and quality system. So right now we're taking all of our data, on stop data, Terry stop data, and we analyzed it, and we're actually using a new model of propensity score matching where we can actually be able to break down and hold it for certain variables, whether somebody is potentially, you know, biased policing or they're stopping people of color at a higher rate. Mm. But it allows us to also do it in real time rather than wait for data that came 2 years ago and then be able to make those changes. Mm. The second part of it is that we're actually using all of our vehicle data information, so the GPS on our vehicles, and we're identifying how we police, whether it's over-policing a community or under-policing a community, so we can better respond to the community's needs. And then the third component is actually our quality data, which is really taking and analyzing our body cameras and being able to capture the voices and see if there is anything that we're escalating or de-escalating in a situation to really enhance our customer service. So these are game changers to how we're actually doing policing and how we're changing culture.
Okay.
So unpacking that comment.
Oh, my goodness.
So the positive.
I feel like I have a pitchfork and I'm trying to, you know, move horse.
So his comment about, you know, positive culture and negative culture, and then when he talks about the negative culture, he says, quote, "You really create this environment where people are not happy with their work," end quote. So of course he's looking at it the police officer's perspective.
Yes.
This is not what the question was about. It's not what the community thinks of as negative
and,
culture. Yes.
And yeah, so when the public hears that question, they're usually thinking of officers who treat the general public like an enemy combatant.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, with the appropriate level of violence that's involved in that, the dehumanization and all the rest of it. And he sidestepped that concern entirely. He did not mention it at all. He's strictly talking about are officers happy with their jobs? You know, if they could only.
Do they have access to wellness dogs?
Yeah, exactly. And you know, if they could only beat up a few more people and they'd be happier and we'd have the problem solved. I mean, it is so completely tone deaf
It really shows you why there is that the negative culture persists, is because there is no understanding at the top currently at SPD of what the community is really demanding.
I would argue that there's no understanding of it in the mayor's office either.
Yeah.
Which is what oversees the new police chief and will pick the new police chief. They're not even thinking of that as a concern, or as a certainly as a priority to change. And it needs to change to the extent you could make a case for disbanding SPD entirely and starting over. It's been so bad for so long. And is so entrenched that, you know, it's the air they breathe. They don't even understand that there's air there. It's really mind-boggling that after so long, you know, 10 years of a reform process, and we have gotten absolutely nowhere within SPD.
In terms of the culture. Now he did talk about, of course, technology and data. Right. And I listened to all that and I'm like, okay, there's been no mention of these programs before. And sure, I really believe that you're as short staffed as you've been complaining that you are, and you're getting all this data analysis done. I really don't believe that. Okay. I have to say, I'm sorry. I really don't believe that. Now, Greening, the assistant chief at SPD, he was really big on getting the department out from under the Department of Justice oversight, which when he was asked the same question, which made me scratch my head and think, God, I guess he wants the cultural change to be rolled backwards to pre-2012, you know? I'm like, okay, you're really saying that the culture is going to change at SPD once the feds are gone and you're no longer under the police reform process. That's really backwards thinking. But I think Greening was the candidate who was really the one doing the dog whistles to the SPOG union members and those reactionary elements within SPD who just wanna go back to business as usual. Kevin Hall responded.
And, you know, if he wants to get out from the from under federal oversight, you know, SPOG needs to ratify a contract and needs to ratify a contract with the reform measures that have been suggested by the court and suggested by the city council.
Well, and that were passed into law by the city council. SPOG has yet to do that, to adopt those measures that are now law. Under the city's legal apparatus, and SPOG has not done that yet. Now, Kevin Hall from Tucson, he said that as a new leader, you have to be an agent for change, but you have to also get buy-in from your staff within the department, or the change doesn't happen. But he didn't specify how he'd get that. So really, among the three candidates, nobody had a satisfactory answer to this question. And Hall didn't really talk about what that cultural change should be, which I thought was also kind of interesting. So again, you know, when you're looking at a police chief from within the current, you know, United States police culture, kind of the broader culture, you're going to get what you get, essentially. So now the fourth question was, under your leadership, what will SPD's mission and vision be? And first off, Greening, again, is just the bust heads and take names kind of guy.
Our mission is to hurt as many people as possible.
Yeah. And he mentioned again, making people feel comfortable walking down the street with their kids and their dogs, and that they shouldn't have to, quote unquote, fear crime. Right. You know, so again, he's the let's roll back to pre-2012, right? Now, he said multiple times that his vision aligns with Mayor Harrell's, and of course, we all know what Bruce Harrell thinks about all this. Don't make any changes, right? Now, Adrian Diaz did a lot more touchy-feely talk, like you just heard him do, about empathy and compassionate policing within a beloved community, blah, blah, blah. And I was like, oh my God, I got to go take a shower now after I heard his response to that question. And then Kevin Hall, the guy from Tucson, he said that the mission would be pretty much the same as it currently is, to ensure safety along with the support of the community. And getting community buy-in means transparency and trust. If there's bad news, don't cover it up. Just get it out there and take responsibility for it. And I have to say that that would be new for the city of Seattle police department.
It would be very new.
Yeah. And of course, I don't want to say anyone really had the best answer to that question, because I really think it was a horrible question. There it is. Now, question five was all about hiring more SPD officers, quote, in the current political climate, end quote, which is a loaded question if I've ever heard one. And it assumes that we need a lot more officers instead of offloading a bunch of busy work from the SPD, first off. And that it also assumes that there's something wrong with the current political climate in Seattle, yet doesn't really specifically say what that might be. Which is what made this probably one of the worst of the questions. Although I think there was a lot wrong with most of these questions. Now, Adrian Diaz responded with, of course, more touchy-feely stuff. Essentially, he tried to change the SPD brand so that Seattle cops would be perceived as helpers, and he would try to recruit more people from outside of criminal justice programs. He also mentioned the importance of a new SPOG contract with better benefits and better pay to, make SPD officers feel like they're being pampered, I guess. Then he mentioned the new hiring bonuses, and he really perked up. He very happily pointed out that a $30,000 bonus is almost enough for a down payment on a home. which I kind of nodded and said,
maybe 10 years ago.
I kind of nodded and I said, yeah, that's $30,000 bonus is a real cherry on top, right? But more importantly, he said that the messaging in the news media has to be positive so more officers will want to move here.
and the Como TV reporter was busy taking notes at that point.
Yeah. He really, really singled out the news media there. And the media in general there, which I thought was very interesting. And that's really the Harrell administration. Bruce Harrell has said that multiple times, that communication with the public and talking up the brand and getting positive press is so important to him, you know. Whereas, those of us in the media really see the role of the media as a watchdog, and that, does not enter the conversation or the consciousness of these folks at all. So Eric Greening, the assistant chief at the SPD, he said exactly the same kinds of things, but he was even more supportive of solving the quote unquote labor issues. In other words, getting a new primo contract for the Seattle Police Officers Guild. In addition, as chief, he said he would work on retention by meeting with individual officers and then just giving them whatever they want.
Yeah.
Right? So we know where he's coming from. Kevin Hall from Tucson talked a lot about internal pride within the department, and although he didn't mention the SPOG contract, he said that the SPD should have the best equipment, the best cars, the best IT, etc., and feel like they're the best department in Washington State, if not the nation. So again, you're talking about making sure that those officers are really pampered, right? He talked about brand position.
Yeah, new toys. SPD really needs new toys. They've got so many already.
Well, they used so many of those toys during the 2020 protests that, they probably are a little low on their tear gas stash.
Well, now at the same time, morale is down because they haven't had a chance to use it since then.
Yeah, that's true. They got really practiced at doing it, and now they haven't been able to roll it out in a while. So their morale's a little low. Hall also talked about brand positioning, which that was his own terminology. He also mentioned one big hurdle, though, that the other two candidates didn't mention, which is the fact that even if the SPD were to hire 100 new recruits in the next month, there isn't enough space in the state training academy to handle that many SPD recruits at once. So there's a big kink in the pipeline that slows down hiring.
Oops.
So even when answering a truly horrible question like this, Hall still seems to know more about the actual process than the two candidates who've been working in the SPD for decades. Okay. So I thought that was pretty telling. So now the sixth question was about accountability. He kind of left for last here. And the question was worded very vaguely again. How will you address mistakes when they occur? And how will you hold yourself and your employees accountable? Now, Diaz mentioned the riots around the George Floyd protests and said that he had to apologize to the community, then had his officers engage with the community. Now, he didn't define the terms riot. Did he mean police riot or did he mean the protesters? You know? And he didn't define the term community. Did he mean that he had to apologize to lower ranking officers at the SPD who are his own community? Or did he mean the protesters and residents of Seattle who were tear gassed and pepper sprayed repeatedly by the police, even though the protests were largely peaceful? He didn't define those two terms. He mentioned having to acknowledge the problem, but then he didn't go on to tell us what the problem was, which I think is what is truly wrong with the current culture at the SPD, right? We don't get an understanding of where they're coming from when they think there's a problem or they think there's been a riot. Clearly, in my mind, they're thinking the problem and the riot is people exercising their First Amendment right to peacefully protest, right? And then when the chief of police apologizes, it's a public relations stunt to try to make the officers beneath them feel like they're getting an apology from the chief of police because he, I don't know, didn't have a good protest response policy in place or something that protected those officers and made them feel pampered and allowed them to use even more chemicals on people who were exercising their right to free speech. Now, Eric Greening said that he knows the ins and outs of the current accountability process for the SPD, but that it's confusing for officers beneath him in the hierarchy. So he appeared to be wishing for the good old days before the DOJ stepped in to implement police reform and the OPA existed as a minor office within the Seattle Police Department and had no power to actually exercise any oversight over SPD officers. He kind of talked around the whole issue, but that's really how it came across to me. Kevin Hall again said that it's important to own up to your mistakes. When he was asked for a specific example, he said he couldn't give specifics, but he'd had at least one issue where he didn't handle staff in a way that was sensitive to the severity of the outcome. He seems like he's so really it made him seem like he's a very technical guy who doesn't have a lot of touchy-feely skills that Adrian Diaz has, and that there are pluses and minuses to that. Okay, so the pluses are that you're probably going to get a straight answer from him, and that he's going to not give you any BS. The minus to that is that he may not be the best guy to handle a large department with a lot of people who do need a good HR person to oversee discipline. So there are pluses and minuses to that. Okay. And then I'm going to skip over the final question, which was the standard. Why do you think you're the best person for this job? Which I think is really just a measurement.
What color are your favorite socks?
Yeah, I think it's really just a measurement of how egotistical a person is. Either you say, as Kevin Hall did, if you want somebody different, I'm your guy, or you're just sitting there bragging about the stuff that you've had to do, which is really just a routine part of your job, which is what Hall and Diaz did. So that's really my summation of the forum. You can watch the recording on the Seattle channel online. And then they give you a link to give your feedback on the forum, which is basically just a box where you type in your thoughts, or you can skip that part. Now, Mayor Bruce Harrell is going to be making his decision soon on which of those three candidates he wants to be the
and
next
that,
chief.
And that was the only forum. I should.
Yeah, that was the only public forum. Yeah. And of course they didn't, it wasn't a real forum, so they didn't take questions from the audience. And, these questions were almost certainly given to them beforehand because, they were so quick on their answers. Now, Mayor Harrell is going to make his decision soon, and then he'll send his preferred candidate to the city council, and they will vote to approve or not approve that person for the next chief of police. Now, I think Mayor Harrell is probably going to just put forward Adrian Diaz. He said in the past that he really is pleased with how Diaz has been running the department, and he encouraged him to put in his application to be the permanent chief of police. So I'm thinking he's leaning in that direction. I think Hall would be the better choice because apparently he knows a heck of a lot more about what is possible here in the state of Washington and in Seattle than these other two candidates. And I think if Bruce Harrell puts forward Eric Greening, that people should contact the city council and urge them to vote no on him for sure.
Yeah, I would say that given the history of internal hires for a chief of police at SPD, Hall has got to be the best choice.
Yeah. But we'll see. He summed it up when he basically said, hey, if you want somebody from the outside, I'm your guy. And it's important to know that the judge who is in charge of the police reform monitoring here in the city of Seattle has really urged the city to bring in someone from the outside to change the culture at SPD. We'll see if Harrell takes that advice.
Yeah.
I'm not optimistic that he will.
No.
All right.
I'm just not.
All right. Related to that, you touched on 9/11 responses.
Yeah, this week's meeting on September 13th of the Public Safety and Human Services Committee in the City Council, they heard a presentation on the work plan for the mayor's office and the council central staff to implement a pilot alternative 911 response program. This is something that both Lisa Herbold and particularly Andrew Lewis have been pushing for a while. And Lewis in particular has made multiple complaints about how it's taken a long time to get this small pilot program up and running. Well, the mayor's office and the council central staff have come up now with a work plan to get something rolling. And that work plan has two goals within it. The two goals are to develop a strategy for the city's 911 emergency response system that diversifies, this is directly from the work plan, diversifies the city's emergency response options to better meet the community's need, including non-law enforcement response. In other words, behavioral health crisis calls, for example. It would reduce harm and it would preserve first responder capacity for appropriate emergency response calls, like priority one and priority two calls. And it would increase the rate of response and timeliness to those lower priority calls that currently are not being answered. And if they're being answered at all, it's very, very late. It's a long response time after the calls were made. And then the second goal is to develop a pilot response program to be implemented next year in 2023. And then there are four results that are supposed to come out of this work plan. First off is a policy document that includes a call analysis, a risk management analysis, and a look at the best practices from other jurisdictions. That's due by the end of the year, having a policy document in place. The second result is to get the pilot program up and running during 2023. It's to get a policy document around that program, how it's supposed to operate, and what the outcomes, you know, what a successful outcome would be, and then get that program up and running. The third thing is to get a policy in place to move special events out of the Seattle, special event staffing out of the Seattle Police Department, so that you don't have officers with a gun and a badge being the guys who man safety at a Seahawks game, for example. That's something that civilian responders can be doing, and that's the first chunk of busy work that can be moved out of the SPD. And then the fourth result is a communication strategy. So something that I'm sure was insisted on by Bruce Harrell is to have some kind of a communication strategy to inform the public on what the changes are and where they can go if they need help on specific things.
And how to spin them in the best possible way.
Yeah, and of course, how to make it all look really good. Because that's Bruce Harrell's main thing, is how do you make everything look really good, right?
Yeah, how do you convince people that, that this is new when it's not?
Yeah, or make it look like we're constantly moving forward, you know?
Yeah.
No bad news here.
It may be in a giant circle, but we are constantly moving forward.
Yeah, nothing to see here. move along. Yeah. So some of the, and of course there was a timeline process too. So some of the things are happening right now as we speak and need to be done are listed as things that they want to accomplish in September. So for example, coming up at the next Public Safety and Human Services Committee meeting on the 27th is the SPD's finally coming out with a presentation on their risk management demand analysis. So their look at 911 calls and trying to identify those calls that could be moved out of the Seattle Police Department to a civilian team, but what they think the outcome of those calls, some of those past calls could be. So for example, when someone calls 911, the call center team categorizes that call as either priority 1, 2, 3, or 4. And the Seattle Police Department wanted to do a look at whether those calls ever shifted from, say, a priority 3 call to a priority 1 call and how often that happened. That's the risk management demand analysis, and they want to present that to the city council. My guess is they're going to try to make the argument that a lot of calls get shifted to a higher priority, and I think it's going to be important for the city council members to dig into the details of that and ask for, okay, when does that happen, and really how often?
Yeah.
So that's coming up at the next Public Safety and Human Services City Council meeting on the 27th, and we'll talk about that.
Okay. All right. Well, sticking with things, categories, things that relate to Mayor Harrell, the yes. Esquire Club came up for coverage.
Yeah. This week, the mayor's office announced the finalists to receive funding through the city's Equitable Development Initiative, which is a program that's meant to help stabilize communities of color in the city and prevent gentrification from driving them out of town. So in the past, the city council has spent about $5 million per year. The city has spent about $5 million per year to do things like build affordable housing and support cultural spaces run by community nonprofit groups. And those cultural spaces tend to be open to the entire community. So for like example, like a community center. Now this week, both Erica Barnett at Publicola and David Goodman at the Seattle Times reported that this year's list included a $781,827 grant to a private men's club, the Royal Esquire Club, that Bruce Harrell is listed as the board member and chair of the club's executive committee, and he's been in that capacity for many years. Now, a Harrell spokesperson said that Harrell had resigned from the club in November of last year, but he was still listed on the club's website, although I checked again on Friday and his name had been removed. So maybe the website was out of date, maybe not, I don't know. Now the club's website also describes it as a quote unquote privately owned social club, end quote. And another quote.
That sounds like a strip club, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does, doesn't it? But another quote is, membership requires both a financial and civic commitment, end quote. And I should point out, it's not open to just anyone who can afford the financial commitment. The website says towards the bottom of, you know, about the Esquire Club, the website says, quote, candidates for membership must be sponsored by existing club members, end quote. So, you know, men's social clubs have been around forever, for hundreds of years, right? And typically they involve the wealthier male business owners and politicians within the community. In this case, the black community. It's a place for them to go to get drinks, to harass the female staff, to, you know, rub elbows, make off-color jokes, and, you know, do networking to cut business deals. To, you know, when you hear about that deal was cut in a smoky back room at the local men's club, this is what we're talking about, right? Now, and while the website for the Esquire Club says there's, quote, a civic commitment, that means you might expect that to mean extensively supporting the black community. Well, no. The extent of that commitment appears to be just a small scholarship program. That's really typical of these men's clubs. They really exist mostly to serve the wealthier, more prominent business owners within a community. Now, the club facilities are, of course, mostly a hangout for hosting parties and swanky social events, and you can see that from looking at the website. Erica Barnett noted that the amount of the city's grant to the club is more than double the club's annual revenue, which is about $359,000. And that was before the pandemic struck. Now, the wording on the grant was that the club needed the money to, quote, support rehabilitation of existing cultural space. In other words, it sounds like they're going to be using that money to do a nice swanky renovation. Now, while Harrell's staff was quick to say that the mayor didn't have anything to do with reviewing or approving the grant, Harrell has gone to bat for the Esquire Club before. He even resorting to making threats against the city's labor standards office when he was city council president back in 2018. He chewed out an investigator in the labor standards office for looking into complaints by five women who were owed overtime pay by the club. Harrell threatened to cut funding to the labor standards office if they didn't drop the investigation. Nevertheless, the investigation continued and the club ended up paying $12,000 in back pay and penalties in that case. And yet, even though they had those complaints against them, they still qualified for an almost $800,000 city grant. Erica Barnett also pointed out that the Esquire Club got 100% of what they requested in their application versus other recipients who pretty typically only receive a portion of what they requested. So that looks to me like some suspicious activity there. And I think it's an issue that's ripe for follow up by the local media.
Yeah.
Supreme Court ruling on Big Bertha.
Yeah, the state Supreme Court ruled on the costs for the 2-year delay in building the Highway 99 tunnel. Folks may remember Big Bertha, the huge drilling machine that broke down in December 2013 while drilling that big tunnel under downtown. It sat idle for over 2 years while Hitachi built a new drill head, shipped it from Japan over to the United States, hoisted the old broken drill head out of the ground, and then replaced it with the new one. That cost Seattle Tunnel Partners, which is the coalition of contractors that built the tunnel, about $600 million, and it cost the state who knows how many millions of dollars in lost time and lost use of the new tunnel. Seattle Tunnel Partners sued the state to try and recover that $600 million. But two courts have already ruled in the state's favor on that case, a Thurston County Superior Court and an appeals court. This week, the state Supreme Court ruled in a parallel case that the insurance companies that covered the construction project are not required to reimburse the state of Washington for damages related to the 2 years of lost time on the project. Instead, the court sent the case back to the appeals court, which ruled last year that the insurers weren't liable for intangible damages like lost time. And taxpayers aren't on the hook either. When Seattle Tunnel Partners sued the state of Washington, they lost in a jury trial when they couldn't prove that the state was at fault for the breakdown. In fact, there's every evidence that Seattle Tunnel Partners ran the drill too hot and too fast in order to win an early completion bonus from the state, which was written into the contract.
And which they did not receive.
Yeah, and that's probably a major cause of the breakdown. Now, in addition, there are still questions about whether the drill head was big enough for the job or if the steel pipe that the drill head hit was marked on the plans or not, and who put it in the ground in the first place. So the whole legal morass over this issue is not over by far. And it's,
there were many, many lawsuits that came out of that fiasco.
Yeah, and it's not looking good for the Seattle Tunnel Partners. And by the way, in case you don't know, the Seattle Tunnel Partners is a coalition of two construction companies, Dragados USA, which is the New York-based branch of the Spanish company ACS Group, and Tudor Perini Corporation, which is a big construction company based in California. Those are the folks who were trying to recover costs in this case this week, and they lost. So good news for taxpayers, though. We are not on the hook for that, at least not yet.
All right. Okay, so that leaves us all of 2 minutes for a job. You can select whatever national items you can squeeze into that.
The Trump crime family saga will continue, so we can come back to that next week. I want to talk about the Republican, the latest appeal to culture war outrage, which is shipping asylum-seeking immigrants to blue states, saying, you want these people? Here, have them. And owning the libs that way, because that owning the libs is the only purpose of this. And the whole idea that har, we showed them, with live people and live families that are desperate, and that are being lied to about what's at the other end of that journey. So that happened certainly with the Venezuelan immigrants who landed in Martha's Vineyard this week. Martha's Vineyard is, of course, a famous resort island off of Massachusetts, but it only has about 20,000 permanent residents, and the summer jobs are gone. So there's no jobs there for these people. There's no housing. And that was the point. The cruelty is always the point with Republicans. So Ron DeSantis was crowing about this. Even though the immigrants were shipped from Texas, somehow he's justifying it as keeping Florida clear of immigrants. We saw Governor Greg Abbott in Texas ship busloads of immigrants to Chicago. And there's no warning at the other end of these jurisdictions. They just abruptly show up, and the local officials have to figure out what to do with them. And in the case of Martha's Vineyard, local private citizens were stepping up to offer housing and shelter and clothing and all the things that people need when they are desperate. So it's an incredibly cynical and entirely political ploy and it's really disgusting. People are mentioning human trafficking. Human trafficking laws probably don't apply here because they're often written to try and interfere with forced sex work, but they should apply in this case because you're using human beings to further your political agenda, and you're lying to do it. It's really revolting.
Well, that's all the time we got for this week, but
I'm sure we'll have more cheery news next week.
Yes,
we had a couple good items this week, so that was encouraging. So we're not all downers.
Although that might be the last good news they hear for the year.
that is also a possibility, yes. In about 3 weeks, we'll start talking about what's on the ballot in Seattle, too.